Okay. All right, so I wanted to continue. We had started a few weeks ago with the story of Yosef and his brothers, which I think I mentioned that I found it to be the most, I guess, gut-wrenching and the most dramatic story in the entire Torah, especially last Shabbos when the reunion of the brothers. It's extremely dramatic and shocking. You can imagine the shock in the room that that the brothers had to feel. So let me just start off with one point over here. I have a few different points. We'll see how far we can get. But I think this is, take a look. If you have your Chumash, that would be in Parshas Miketz. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. That would be in Parshas Vayigash. Last week's Parsha is Vayigash. And Yehuda makes his dramatic appeal because Yosef has set up Binyamin, his younger brother, by placing the goblet in his saddle, unbeknownst to all of them, and having his man go after them and accuse them, and it was a setup. So then his position was that Binyamin has to be a slave to me because of this theft. Now, of course, that would be devastating to Yaakov. So Yehuda steps forward and he makes a dramatic plea. I mean, you see the greatness of Yehuda because he had guaranteed that he would bring back Binyamin. And now he pleads with Yosef to allow him, Yehuda, to take the place of Binyamin. So he's essentially giving up his life. He's giving up, or put it a different way, he's giving up his freedom, which is pretty much tantamount to giving up his life, to be in a place. Excuse me, somebody, I hear a noise, like a tearing noise or something like that. So I'd appreciate it if that could be, if we could control that. Anyways, so that is when Yosef sees that, he decides that it's time to reveal himself. Because the whole purpose of everything that he had done was not to inflict pain. It may seem that way superficially, that Yosef is accusing the brothers of being spies, and he's taking one of them, that Shimon, and telling them that they can't come back and get more food unless they bring Binyamin down. All of this was not being done for the sake of revenge at all, as we will soon see. What was he doing this for? Let's put it, that's a big question in the story. Why did he not acknowledge who he was when he first recognized them and they didn't recognize him? And instead, he makes them go through this whole drama before he finally decides he can reveal himself. What was the purpose behind everything that he was doing? His manipulations. He puts the money back in their saddles, giving them the fear that they didn't know whether that was just an accident or they were being set up for something. He put them in a state of tension. And then, of course, he brings them back and he brings them to his house and seemingly everything is all right. But then again, he subjects them to suspicion with the goblet. And then he pretends that he's going to be locking up Binyamin for the rest of his life, which engenders the intervention of Yehuda. Finally, after Yehuda steps forward and, does his piece, then he decides the time has come. What was the purpose of all of that? Anyone? No.
He was
messing with them.
Oh, sorry.
Right?
Hold on. No, notice that at certain key points, you can't help but note that he turns aside and cries. At a few key points, when he hears the brothers, recounting that they're guilty because of they were unmerciful and so on, he turns aside and he cries. So that proves that he's not doing this in order to harm them, because why would he cry? Yeah, I'm
right.
Sorry.
He, even when he reveals himself at one point, he says, like, although you intended it for harm, Hashem intended it for good. And
right.
I think that he also, hi, my name's Amanda, by the way. He also, he wants them, he wants to give him the opportunity to do shuva, but I think that he also like wants to see that they won't do the same thing to Benjamin like that they did to him. So although like we don't think that it was for personal satisfaction, I think that like he wants to make sure that his like full brother will be treated with dignity and respect.
Okay, that's very good. That's very good. Does anybody want to add to that? I think it's clear that was Amanda, I believe. I think it's clear that he was doing it purely for the sake of creating situations which would cause them to do tshuva.
Are you saying that he did this to make sure that they changed?
Yes. Yes, he did this, right. It's a very, of course the question arises, you could ask this question, who gave him the right to do this? What right do you have to inflict pain on people because you feel that it will, are you allowed to do that? Let's say you have...
I think in his case, he's allowed to do that.
Right. What gives him the right?
Because he's...
Are you allowed to do that in general? In other words, let's say you're going in a bad way, your lifestyle and so on and so forth, and I'm trying to convince you to get back on the track. You know, you're running around.
What
you're staying out. Let me finish. Would I be permitted to say, let's say if I took away your car, if I stole your car, I mean, temporarily, I'll give it back to you later, but this will prevent you from running around and it'll force you to stay home and it'll make you a better person. Do I have a right to do that, to intervene in a person's life for a good purpose? Does the end justify the mean?
Maybe no. Only a parent.
I'm sorry?
A young kid.
A parent with a young kid. Yeah, that's true, because the young kid is not an independent, autonomous individual. He's under the care of the parent. So that's a different story. But I'm talking about an adult to adults. It's not even your child. I'm concerned about you. I am concerned about you. And I want to save you. But in order to do so, I've got to cut off your money supply. So I'm going to steal your money. I'm not going to keep it. I'm going to put it in a box. And when you do tshuva, I'm going to give it back to you. May I do a thing like that? May I intervene?
I think it depends on your role, Rabbi Man. I think it depends on who you are and what your relationship is to the person. And I think that Yosef created an opportunity for his brothers to do the right thing after doing the wrong thing. And I think that they had two intentions. One, like he wanted them to do tshuva for what they did. And two, he wanted them to but you can do it. Depends on your relationship. Like you can't just like go to your next door neighbor and be like, it smells, you're smoking cigarettes, so I'm going to decide to call Con Ed and turn off your lights. Like, you have to have a relationship with the person, you know?
But if I have a relationship with you, then I can do it?
Depends who you are and what kind of reckless behavior is going on, I think.
You're basically saying that you can't do it. It's just that you can't do. You have to do it for cause, is what you're saying. You can't just do it. But if so, you're saying that the ends justify the means in this situation. What you're saying
for Yosef, but it doesn't always in other situations.
Right. It's a case by case basis.
There's a case. The Gemara talks about this. I don't know if you remember Chana, and Chana. Chana was the mother of Shmuel, Samuel, the prophet. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, so you remember that. Hi. She couldn't have children. I assume you're somewhat familiar with the story. So this pained her greatly. And finally she made that vow that if you'll give me a child and I'll devote him to Hashem, you know, he'll be raised as a Nazirite and so on and so forth. But she had what I guess we would call a co-wife, because in those days a person could have more than one wife. So her husband had another wife whose name was Penina. And Penina used to kind of taunt her. She would always be reminding her of the fact that she didn't have any children. However, the Gemara says she did it in order to, not to hurt her feelings, but just to make her pray harder and try harder, because she really wanted her to have a child. Okay? So here's a case where she did something which would be wrong. You're not allowed to taunt a person verbally. You're not allowed to afflict a person. but she did it for a positive purpose, and in fact, it worked. Okay, was that a legitimate thing for her to do? A similar situation. Let's say I know someone. She can't have children, or she can't find a guy. But I think it's because she's not trying hard enough. She's not taking care of herself. She's letting herself go. And if she worked harder, she'd definitely be able to. So I started. I'm kind of like taunting her, making her feel bad, but for a good, only to get her going. Am I allowed to do that? So the Gemara says, that's an interesting question. It's an interesting question, right? Something which you're not allowed to do, but you're doing it for a really good purpose. The Gemara says that she was punished, Penina, because she has no right to inflict pain on someone. It doesn't matter. In other words, the end does not justify the means. The end does not justify the means. What I could do, however, I could talk to her in a nice way and explain to her and how much happy you'd be and so on and so forth. That I'm allowed to do. But to adopt a different technique, which is not permitted, you're not allowed to, verbal affliction is a prohibition. You're not allowed to afflict another person. Just make them feel bad, insult them because of their looks, because of anything. So therefore, if that is the case, then Yosef would not be allowed to do. I mean, he did serious stuff. He put them in jail. He put all of them in jail. Then he took them out. And what about his accusation against Binyamin? Binyamin hadn't sinned against him. You could figure that out. I mean, Binyamin was not in the plot of the brothers to sell him. He wasn't even there. And he never would have allowed it to happen because he loved Yosef. He was his older brother.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Could it be kind of like an eye for an eye, that type of thing? Because everything he did to his brothers, he got done to him. He was put in jail. He was tricked. And so could it be like that type of a thing?
He was falsely accused, by the way.
Yeah, his right. Brothers,
she accused him of raping her, or trying to rape her, not raping.
Yeah, he didn't. So it's very similar.
Okay, but so let's, do you have a right to do that? Do you have a right to play the game that way, so to speak? I mean, we're talking
about... Doesn't it say in the Torah, an eye for an eye?
Yeah, but an eye for an eye means for a criminal. And that's being, by the way, I just want to make it clear. An eye for an eye is not meant to be taken literally. It means monetarily. Okay? The oral law teaches a... In fact, in the Gemara, there's tractates on whole chapters on how do we evaluate the monetary worth of limbs. So it never, ever was taken in the literal sense. It means repayment. Okay, I just wanted to make that clear. But that is being done by the court. That's not done by an individual. Okay? So if somebody punches you, I mean, and then you wait 3 days later, you wait for a chance and you punch him back, and you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to do that. I'm at the moment, in terms of self-defense, then you're permitted to defend yourself. So you can punch him back. But I mean to say that it doesn't work that way, that if someone spoke Lashon Hara about you, that doesn't give you the right to speak Lashon Hara about them. In other words, two wrongs don't make a right. Okay? So take a look at I want to share with you an interpretation of, because that is a very serious question. Yosef could have rebuked them. He had every right to rebuke them and to challenge them. Why did you do such and such to me? But he didn't have a right to do the things that he did, except in this case, someone gave him permission to do it. In fact, somebody appointed him to do it. Take a look at chapter 42, verse 9. Oh, let's go to verse 8. If you have a chumash there. Okay, my fast is over. Just taking a little break. That's good. Okay. This is talking about when Yosef sees the brothers. The brothers have come down in order to purchase food, and Yosef made it a point to be there by the border control. So it says, Yosef saw his brothers and he recognized them and he acted strange towards them. That is, so they shouldn't recognize him. And he spoke harshly with them. And he said to them, from where have you come? And they said, from the land of Canaan to acquire food. And Yosef recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. I want you to know that statement has meaning on many levels. On the practical level, it means they just didn't identify, recognize him. But on a deeper level, it means that they never recognized his greatness. He recognized them, their proper place, but they never recognized his real greatness. That's why they plotted even to kill him and eventually to sell him. Now listen to the next verse very carefully. It says, Yosef remembered the dreams that he had dreamed about them, and he said to them, you are spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. And then they deny it and so forth. Now,
wait, can I say something about that? Then the dreams were ordained by Hashem because he was like a Navi. So then perhaps Hashem gave him the like ability and the like sort of go to be able to do this.
Yeah. To be a little bit very good. That's very good intuition. To be a little bit more specific, it says that he remembered the dreams. Now, if you remember, there were two dreams. The first dream was about the bundles surrounding his bundles and bowing down to his bundles. The second dream was the sun and the moon and 11 stars bowing down to him. So what was the difference between the two dreams? Both of them show Yosef in a position of dominance over his brothers. The first one shows him having power economically. That's the economic, because the bundles represent the economics. So he would be in charge of the economic, and they would be dependent upon him economically. The second one, the sun and the moon and the stars, that depicts the spiritual aspect, spiritual beings, which indicates that he would be in charge, he would be the master over them from the spiritual standpoint, that is in terms of the religion, the ideas, and so on and so forth. So Rabbi Chaid interpreted this way, that he remembered both dreams. That is, he suddenly realized that the two dreams were connected. That is, that the means, the economics, would be the means by which he would attain the spiritual power. That he would become the spiritual leader of his brothers, but as a result of the fact that he would wield economic power over them. So that's what he suddenly realized. He was in that situation. Because they were coming down to him for economic dependence. They were dependent upon him to provide them. So he took that. His understanding was that he should utilize that opportunity to now become the spiritual ruler over them. That was really from God. In effect, then, God was telling him to use your power to bring about, if you're the spiritual leader, your task is to bring them to do tshuva. And that's when he came up with these ideas of how to do it. That is, as you said, to put him in a situation where they would have to confront what they had done to him and to do tshuva for it. He did that because he was commanded to do it by Hashem. But he didn't do it because of his own desire. He had overcome. I mean, it's an amazing phenomenon that he had overcome any personal animosity. And that's one of the great, I call last week's Torah, or I write a Torah article every week. If you want, you could probably ask Rabbi Rosenthal. I always refer to Yosef as the champion of forgiveness. I mean, put yourself in his position. Could you just let go of everything they had done to him and tried to do to him and completely forgive them? Not just forgive them, but he brought them down. He sustained them. He provided for them for the remainder of their lives, basically. So it's clear then, that he was not doing this because of personal desire. You see his greatness also in that he had a tremendous emotional desire to reveal himself, to reunite with them. You see that when he actually does reveal himself. And he kissed every one of them and hugged them. So it had to be painful for him. Certainly, Yaakov, it had to be very painful for him to do what he was doing, because it was putting off the reunion. It was delaying the reunion and seeing them go through the pain. But nevertheless, that's part of his greatness, that he didn't follow his natural course of his instincts, of his emotions. But he did that which he had to do because of the dream, which was essentially a communication. So let's continue along these lines. Let's see what happens. So the brothers now, they're put in that position. What are you talking about? It's like, oh, no, my master. Your servants have come. We've come to bring food, to get food. We're all the son of one man. We're straight, honest people. We're not spies. In other words, this was the most shocking thing. Because what they're basically saying is that we're all part of one family. So governments don't send 10 brothers on a spying mission. That doesn't make sense. First of all, it's less, you don't send big groups, and they're all together, and certainly they're not members of one family. So that was their counterclaim. But Yosef is tough as nails. He refuses to accept it because he has a goal. His goal is to put them in a situation, and Yaakov too, by the way. Interestingly enough, included in the list of people who had to do tshuva is who? Yaakov. Even though Yaakov obviously didn't sell him, but Yaakov had his quote-unquote sin that he had to atone for. What was the sin of Yaakov?
The sin of Yaakov was that he favored Yosef, right?
Yes. So even that, you see, that's not like a real sin in the sense of a crime. But see, Judaism looks at sin differently. It's a defect from the standpoint of a great tzaddik who should be acting with justice. And also he should not have excessive amount of energy attached to a particular person. So that constitutes something which Yaakov had to quote unquote do tshuva for. So Yosef is tough as nails, and he gets them to spill it all out. They said, we are 12, your servants are 12 brothers, the son of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the younger one, the child, so to speak, although he wasn't a child, is with our father today, and one is no longer around, is missing. That's a reference to Yosef. And Yosef said, that's exactly what I said, you are spies. So then he puts forth his condition. With this, I will test you. As Paro lives, you won't get out of here unless you bring your younger brother here. As he says, send one of you. So his original plan is to hold all of the brothers hostages. Let one of them go back and bring Binyamin, ostensibly to verify their claim. And bring your brother, and you will be locked up in prison, and your words will be tested, whether you're telling the truth. And if not, as Paro lives, you're spies. So Yosef gathers them all in the jail for 3 days. Then you see he changes his tactics. Yosef is acting in a manner which is hard to pin down, because he keeps alternating. He starts off being extremely tough, but then he shows another side, that he has a softer side. So on the third day, Yosef says to them, this is what you shall do and live. I fear the Lord. So he tells them that I fear God. So I'm not just this tyrant, this cruel tyrant. Then he says, if you're honest, then one brother, I only need to keep behind one brother, and the rest of you go and bring food for your people. In other words, your people back there are starving. They're going to need food. So you're going to need a group of brothers to bring back food. All I need is one person to stay behind in order to verify whether you're telling the truth or not. But your younger brother you shall bring to me, and your words will be tested, and you won't die. And they did it. Now, take a look at verse 21. This is a fascinating verse. And each man said to his brother, now we're talking about the brothers, but we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the suffering of his soul when he pleaded with us and we didn't listen. Therefore, has this tragedy, has this trouble come upon us? That's the first verse. Then it says, no, but Reuben answered them, or he responded to them, and he said, did I not tell you? Do not sin against the lad, and you didn't listen? And now his blood is being demanded. And then it says, they did not know that Yosef was listening, because the interpreter. In other words, Yosef wouldn't let on that he knew Hebrew. So he came across to them as an Egyptian ruler, Egyptian, and he had an interpreter. So because he utilized an interpreter, they figured that Yosef did not understand Hebrew. So when they said these things, Yosef, they didn't think Yosef understood. But Yosef actually did. So it says that Yosef turned away and he cried. See, that's the first instance where we see that all this was very painful to Yosef. And he returned to them and he spoke to them. He goes right back into his role, and he took Shimon from them, and he locked him up in their sight. Okay, let's go back now. Tell me what, please go back to verse 21. And each one said to his brother, but we are guilty about our brother, in that we saw the suffering of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we didn't listen. Therefore has this tragedy come upon us. What is difficult about that pasuk?
Wasn't that the proof Joseph needs that they're doing tshuva? They're regretting?
That's true. That is true. But let me ask you a question. I'm sure you've read the initial account, the narrative of the sale of Yosef, right? You've read it. Or if you want to look at it quickly, can you show me over there where it says that Yosef pleaded with him?
Oh, yeah, I don't think he does.
Right, I don't think he says a word. If you read that story, it's like Yosef is absolutely silent. So what's going on over here? Now they're saying that they're guilty because they didn't listen when he pleaded with us. By the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik made the point. He said that the Jews are obligated to do an extra, you know, on Yom Kippur we klop, you know, we al-chait, for the sin, you know, we confess our sins. He said we have to also confess the sin of not doing enough during the Holocaust. Because he says that the Jews are to blame. They could and should have been much more active in protesting and so on and so forth until the government did certain things to alleviate or to try to save more Jews. Now that's, I'm not going into that whole story. But he said, and this is what we should say, this particular verse. This was our sin, that our brothers in Europe were pleading with us, and we didn't listen. We were cold-hearted. It's a very serious thing. It's a very stirring indictment. All right, that's not the topic for tonight. I'm just while we're here, I'm pointing it out to you. But my question is, does anyone have a thought? If you read the story of the sale, it doesn't say that Yosef pleaded with them, that they rejected his pleas. So it's very interesting. You've heard of the Ramban, known as Nachmanides, not Rambam, Ramban with an N, okay? And he says that the Torah is poor in certain places and rich in other places. What does he mean? He means that in certain places, very sparse. There's a lot of sections in the Torah where you wish it would you get some more information. It's very sparse. But it's rich in other places. So what the Torah is doing over here is that it's communicating to us that Yosef pleaded, but only by the recounting of the brothers. Not by describing it when it's happening. It really did happen, but the Torah doesn't describe it. It waits for the recounting. That's the way it's communicating. So in point of fact, he did. But the Torah doesn't tell it to us over there. But through the recounting of the brothers, we learn that it's true. Now, why would the Torah do that? Why do you think the Torah might do that? Why didn't it say so outright? that the brothers took Yosef. Yosef is screaming and he's pleading and they don't care. Why? It doesn't do it that way. It's silent over there. The point only comes out later through somebody's recounting.
Well, it means more coming from them. Like them realizing it, that it was, you know, bad move on their part. If it was just, a story in the Torah with the details, it wouldn't mean as much as coming from them, the people who need to, like, admit it, then, you know, apologize, do tshuva.
Okay. Any other reason? Anybody else? Any other reason why the Torah would do it that way? I think what you're saying is true, but I think there's another factor over here. See, because what kind of a picture do you get about the brothers? When you read that story, doesn't it affect how you feel about the brothers? It seems very cruel to be treating Yosef that way. But we know that all of the brothers were the leaders of Israel, the leaders of tribes. They were truly great people. But the Torah is honest. The fact that they did something wrong doesn't take away from the fact that they're great people. Because even the greatest people, even Moshe Rabbeinu, at some point sinned. There's no such thing as a person that doesn't sin. That's a very important message of the Torah. True greatness does not reside in the fact that a person simply avoids all sin. It really has to do with how he responds to it, to his failures, to his setbacks. And I mean, the message of the Torah is that nobody is born perfect, but it has tremendous confidence that man can attain perfection. I mean, relative, obviously, not absolute, because only God is perfect in that sense. That's a very important message of the Torah. Now, there is a danger. There's a danger when you write biographies of tzaddikim. There is a danger in it, because people have to look up to them. It's necessary. It's very necessary to have role models to look up to. And we model ourselves after them, and they inspire us. But if somebody comes along, this becomes tricky, because when you read about scandals, about people that everyone thought were great, then you read about scandals, so that's it. That destroys the entire image that they had. Now, I'm not saying that you cover up. Can't live that way. I mean, we live a life based on truth. If it turns out that someone who was looked up to was a fraud, was a phony, whether it be a rabbi or some other person, you can't say, we can't publicize this because everybody looks up to him. Because there's the value of truth. But that's a very serious problem. The people over here are great people. They made a mistake. They deliberated. They thought it over. And they came because of his behavior, because of Yosef's behaviors, because of his dreams, and how they understood the dreams. They deemed him to be a big threat to the whole movement that was being developed of the Jewish people. And they came to the conclusion that they had to do this. It was the wrong decision. But there is a danger that we will lose our respect for these people. So therefore, what does it do with this particular? With this particular that he pleaded and they didn't listen. If you would have read that as it's happening, as part of the narrative, then it would be too much. You'd lose your respect for them. How could they be so cold? However, when the same piece of information is given to you as a memory, as a retrospect, it doesn't have the same emotional impact. It does not have the same emotional impact. So I think I'm not sure if the Ramban makes the first point that the Torah is, that it happened, but the Torah chose to convey it this way. My explanation of that is to preserve our respect for the brothers, because they were great people. And it's less of an emotional impact on us if we find out about it through a memory. Okay, that's what I wanted to say on that. So let me ask you a question now. What was Reuven's point? In response to this, Reuven said, but didn't I tell you not to sin against the lad, and you didn't listen, and now his blood is being demanded? What's his point? At first glance, that also sounds a little bit,
Reuven thinks that can I say what Reuven thinks or not yet?
Can you say what?
I think, can I say what Reuven thinks or not yet?
Yeah. I just want to finish stating the question. That is when sometimes people do that. I told you so. What's the point of I told you so? It's done already. We're acknowledging we did something wrong. So why do you have to say I told you so? What was his real point over here? Yeah, go ahead.
So I think that his real point was that perhaps he thought that this was happening because of the bad thing that they did to Yosef. Like, it was sort of like a tikkun, or like maybe on the other hand, revenge. Like, look what happened. You did this to Yosef, and now something terrible is happening to you.
Yeah, but what did he add? What did he add by saying, I told you not to sin against the lad? They already said we're guilty because we were cruel. We were cruel, basically. We didn't pay attention to his pleading. What is he adding? That's my question. What does Reuven add to the mix?
I think that maybe, like, Reuven actually thinks, like, it's like sort of like Hinahara poo-poo-poo. Like, he thinks that maybe this is happening because of the mean things that they did to Yosef. Like, it's more than just, like, I told you not to do that. It's, I told you not to do that, and look how Hashem is punishing us.
Yeah, but the brothers have admitted that. That's what they said. In other words,
when you admit it, doesn't mean anything. Just because they admitted it doesn't, they can't take away what they did.
Another idea could be that they wanted to do this. They wanted to throw him into the pit. Someone, their older brother, told them not to. And even after that, they still did it. So it kind of makes it worse. Like, even after being told not to by someone supposedly wiser, you know, their older brother, they still did it.
That's a very good point. That's an excellent point. That wasn't the point that I intended, but it's still a great point. There's more than one level of interpretation. I think that's excellent, because it's one thing when you do the wrong thing and you acted out some of your emotions, but there was nobody there to instruct you. There was nobody there to tell you not to do it. However, the very same thing, and there were people there that were explaining and said, don't do it, and you still did it, that makes it even worse. I think you're 100% right. But I think there's an additional point over here. See, in verse 21, were the brothers acknowledging that they did the wrong thing? Were they acknowledging that the sale of Yosef was wrong? Should not have, were they recanting? Were they doing tshuva from the sale of Yosef? Take a look carefully at verse 21.
No, they're just recanting for the blood that he was murdered. They think that he was murdered. Because
in verse 21, they don't mention murder. Would you say that verse 21 by itself is really constitutes a good tshuva?
Well, it's just them feeling guilty about them ignoring his pleas. That's
right. So they aren't saying that it was wrong to sell them. They're not saying that. They're not saying we did the wrong thing. That they're still maintaining was correct, because they thought the entire thing over and they decided they had no choice. But what they're saying, what we are guilty for, is the fact that we made this decision without mercy. In other words, according to Jewish law, when you try somebody in a capital case, although it's very rare that the death penalty is ever given, but the judges have to be merciful. They have to be people of justice and people of mercy. And if a person, for whatever reason, it's known that this person has no mercy, he can, even though he's a great genius, he can be the greatest Torah scholar, he cannot sit in a case of capital punishment. So what they were saying is, we still maintain our decision was correct, but we didn't approach it with the proper rahmanas, with the proper compassion and mercy. We were cold. And that's what they're confessing to. That's somewhat of a confession, but it's not a complete confession. Thereby leaving open the door for Reuven to chime in. Reuven was not chiming in because he wanted to say, oh, I told you so, and you didn't listen to that. That's not why he did it. He wanted to go one step further. What was the one step further that he went? No, you're wrong. Your decision was wrong. You had no right to make that decision. And I told you. Of course, you see from the fact that he says, I told you, that the brothers engaged in deliberation. Like a court, like a Sanhedrin has 23 people, and you can't try. This is before the Torah, but after the Torah is given, you can't do a capital case except in a Sanhedrin. So the evidence, after the evidence is accepted, they then have to go around. They debate, and each judge has to express his conclusion, and then they go by a vote. Majority rules. To convict, you need a majority of two. It's made more difficult to convict than to acquit. But to acquit, you only need a majority of one, simple majority. So we see from this that in the deliberations, they had the brothers, the majority was conviction, but you had at least Reuven was his defender. From this, we didn't know this before. We did not know before that, because Reuven says, I argued for the acquittal. Okay, does everybody agree with that? We can see from this verse that Reuven argued to acquit him, to leave him alone. My question to you now is, can you figure out from this verse what exactly was his argument? What argument did Reuven, the argument was rejected by the brothers, but what was his argument for acquittal? For non-conviction. It's in there if you look at it very carefully, and it's in there in one word.
It was just a boy?
Yeah. Keep going. Go ahead. Develop the point.
He was probably saying he's just a little boy. He doesn't know any better. His dreams, whatever. He doesn't deserve a punishment like this.
Excellent. He says, don't sin. Actually, Rabbi Chait pointed this out. Don't sin against the lad. That is to say, you can't make a decision about a person on the basis of youthful exuberance or youthful wildness. That's not the truth. He has elements of greatness to him. But when a person, and I've seen this so many times, I mean, I've been involved in education for many years, and I've seen a lot of people when they first came, they were wild and crazy. They could do the wildest, and everybody said, forget about this, but he's nuts. God knows where he's going to wind up. And yet with study, with discipline and so forth, some of these very same people turned out to be great teachers, great rabbis, great leaders. So what was it? Because the youthfulness was not the essence of the person. He's going to outgrow that. And everybody's like that. I am sure every one of you could look back. You're not that old, but you could look back when you were kids or when you were teenagers, and you might have done some crazy things. And if people judged you on the basis of those crazy things, they would have missed the whole thing. So that was the brothers argued that this is the real Yosef. He's a threat. He's a danger. And we have to deal with him. We can't take a chance with him. Reuven said, absolutely not. That you can't. What you're seeing is not the real Yosef. What you're seeing is a result of a temporary phase. Everybody, as I said, like everybody, when they're young, when they're even great rabbis, they have elements of vanity, ego, wildness. At the same time, and generally, the people that are really unusual, the great geniuses, they do have a tremendous amount of energy. So they do tend to have these, and they're not conformists. They're not like goody two-shoes, if you know what I mean. Okay? Now, I want to take up one more point. I think we have time for one more point, which I started out with. So please turn to the part of the story where Yosef reveals himself, the great reveal. And that's, as we said, that's after the approach of Yehuda. And Yosef believes at this point that the brothers have taken all the steps they need to take. Their tshuva is complete. So he now decides to reveal himself. And that takes place in chapter 45. Chapter 45, you see, it says that Yosef could not control himself anymore because his emotions were so powerful at that point. So he has everybody removed from the room because he didn't want any stranger to be there. He was very careful to protect his brothers. He didn't want to cause them any shame. I mean, if the Egyptians knew what they had done, they would never let the Jews come down. They would never let them come down to Egypt. So nobody is there. Then in verse 2, he let out this loud cry. The Egyptians heard it. And I guess the word spread through Egypt. But let's take a look at the actual moment of the reveal. That's verse 3. And Yosef said to his brothers, I am Yosef. Is my father still alive? And the brothers could not answer him because they were like dumbfounded. They were in a state of shock before him. So once again, I ask you, what's difficult about this verse?
Actually, the conservative Chumash, they translate it to, is my father still well? And even though that's wrong, it does lead to an interpretation of, like, he was wondering, like, if his father survived, like, spiritually and psychologically after losing him. Because if you see throughout before, the brothers tell Yosef that his father is alive. So, like, you have to then think about what does he mean by life? Because they say that if they give up Benjamin, then then Yaakov. So, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. He doesn't. It can't mean that he's asking about physically, if he's physically alive, because it was only, you know, yesterday where they had come down and he had them over to his house and he asked about his father, how's he doing? And they said, he's fine. So they had not gone home in the meantime. This is only a few hours later. So Yosef knew what they knew. So why would he be asking if he's still alive? So again, I want to share a shot with you. I mean, it's along the lines that you said, but not a little bit different. Because Yosef alone understood. Yosef of all the brothers knew the nature of the relationship that Yaakov and him had. And he knew that this would have a devastating, the loss of Yosef would have a devastating impact upon Yaakov. And in fact, we see that because the Torah points out that when he identified the garment to Yaakov, and he said that it's my son Yosef and a wild animal has consumed him. In other words, he acknowledged that that's it, he's gone. So then it says they all came to comfort him and he refused to be comforted. And he said, I'll go down to my grave mourning. So you see that this was, which is not normally the case. Normally a person goes through a period of mourning and then slowly but surely, you know, he comes back to life. But Yosef knew that the matter is not going to be so simple when it comes to Yaakov. Because the loss of someone who's extremely close can have a very profound psychological effect. And the only way, sometimes, the only way that the person can deal with it is by severing the relationship from his mind, mentally. It's like he never knew him. Because if he did, it's just too painful to take. So he sort of withdraws, and that whole area of his life becomes erased. And, you know, that has an effect, because a certain portion of reality becomes removed. He still survives. I mean, he's still alive and so forth, and he's functional, but it has a profound impact. Now, you do see something akin to that, because when the brothers first came back, and they told them that, oh, Yosef is alive and he's the ruler, what was Yaakov's first reaction?
Basically, like, I don't believe you.
Yeah, he refused to believe it. Not because the evidence wasn't good, but psychologically speaking, he was completely removed from the area. And he was very afraid to get back into that area because it's just too painful. You can't go through that pain again. I separated myself. In effect, I don't have a son. I never did have a son. So that, now in point of fact, they showed him the proof and the wagons and so forth, and Yaakov was able to accept it. It's interesting. It's interesting. It seems that Yaakov protected himself against ever allowing himself to get so completely caught up in the love of Yosef. It pointed out when Yosef went out to welcome him, to greet his father as he was coming to Egypt, it says that Yosef fell on his shoulders of his father and cried. He got a tremendous cry. But all the commentators point out, yeah, but Yaakov, it doesn't say that Yaakov cried. Yaakov was preoccupied, they say. He was involved in Kriya Shema. That is, he was taking measures to protect himself. Of course, he loved Yosef. Of course, he wanted to be with him. But that excessive love that he had given into in the first place, he wouldn't go back to that. So that's how Rabbi Chait explained this pasuk. Is my father still alive? My father. That's what he was asking. Not is Yaakov alive? He knows Yaakov is alive. But is he still my father? Is he still my father? Or has the loss, the pain been so great that he psychologically has ceased to be my father? That's what Yosef wanted to know. Is it possible? Can we reinstate the relationship that we once had? So it says, the Gemara says that there was this rabbi that whenever he would read this verse, he would cry. He would cry. And he would say, if the rebuke of flesh and blood caused the brothers to be dumbfounded, they couldn't answer, how much more so the rebuke of God, of the Holy One, blessed be He. So the question is, but where do we see that Yosef rebuked them? Everybody tries to figure out. But the answer is that it wasn't an intentional rebuke. But the question itself constituted a rebuke because it brought home to them that when they acted against... See, it's very, very interesting. It's very interesting. And that is that in the Shemona Esrei, we say about God, Gomel Chasadim Tovim, who brings about good, chesed, you know, compassion, good deeds of compassion. So the question is, but what do you mean good deeds of compassion? Compassion itself is good. Well, why do you have to tell me that good? I mean, that would imply that there's bad compassion. So the answer is, yes, there is. Our compassion is relative. When we do good things for people, we don't really know if it's good. Because let's say you take mercy on someone and you bail them out of a jam or whatever the case may be. It may have been better for you not to bail them out. You never know. Because that might have forced them to change their ways. And the fact that you come in and save them, that enables that you become an enabler. And so on and so forth. So we don't know. We have to do it. We have to act in a certain way. We have to give charity and so on and so forth. But we can never know for sure that the impact is good. But when God does, also for example, let's say the court, let's say they sentence a guy to life in jail because he's a murderer, serial killer, whatever it is, or even the death penalty, whatever it is. Let's say it's a very just verdict. Yeah, but what about the innocent people who are going to suffer as a result? What about his children that didn't do anything wrong and they lose a father? Or what about the poor mother who never did anything wrong and she loses her child? See, so it's impossible. We can't deal with it. We have to have justice and we can't operate with that. But God can. So when God does good deeds, compassion, it incorporates all the factors, all the parties. Not just the ones that are directly involved, but those who are indirectly involved. So the rebuke of Yosef, though not intended, was that you only considered me, what you were going to do to me and what I could do to you. Did you consider the impact this would have on our father? So when the brothers heard that, it had a profound effect upon them. Because now, for the first time, they realized that it was not just against Yosef that they had sinned, but they had sinned against their father. They had blocked that out before, perhaps because they considered their father to be wrong for showing him all of that favor. But now, by virtue of the way Yosef framed the question, is my father still alive? That is to say, is he still my father? Or no, has the action that you've done had such a profound effect that it basically destroyed him as my father, that had an effect. And this rabbi said that if that's the rebuke of flesh and blood. But when we have to face God, we're going to have to be answerable, not just for the things that we did directly, but also indirect harms that we caused by the way we acted. Okay. Okay. Are there any questions or comments at this point?
No, thank you so much. It was awesome.
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you all.
Thanks,
very much.
Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. My pleasure. My pleasure. So we'll be getting together again. Take care. Be well.
Have a good night.
You too. Have a good night. Have a good night. Take care.